Hello. Welcome to Locally Grown. Locally Grown is an audio magazine focusing on ideas, issues, events, and discussion produced for WBCR by Housatonic Radio Works. Hi, I'm Andy Potter. We have one segment for you in today's program. On Saturday, November 18th, Berkshire Grown sponsored a conference on farm-to-school connections. It was co-sponsored by the Massachusetts Farm-to-School Project. It was held at Lenox High School in Lenox, Massachusetts. Today's segment, it was one of the presentations at this conference. We have Deb Phillips, a local nutritionist and health educator, who participated on a panel with Lisa Sylvia, a doctor here in Great Barrington. Deb presented on the topic of nutrition and children's health concerns in America today.
Okay. I'm Debbie Phillips. I'm a nutritionist and a health educator, and I work at the CHP Health Center also. And I do a lot of work around pediatric nutrition and family nutrition and community nutrition and all of the rest. And I'm a firm believer in the fact that healthy eating helps us to get to healthy kids, and that food is a real, it doesn't stand by itself. It sort of is in a whole context of the things that we do. So I'm going to start with basic guidelines, and I'm going to start on produce because fruits and vegetables are absolutely the most important thing that we can be feeding our kids. And we're doing farm to school, and a lot of the products that are available to bring into the school locally are going to be our produce, which is great. But the primary guideline is that kids should eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And we do it because it's an easy count. It's an easy thing to do education around. The real guideline is 5 to 11 servings. And I just want to make sure people know that when we say 5, it's to get everybody up to the minimum and not necessarily even ideal. When we look at most kids' diets, when we look at most adult diets, we don't see 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. So first question to answer is, what is a serving? Because that's just a question that most people don't know the answer to. A serving is a tennis ball-sized piece of fruit. That means that if you have one of those giant mutsu apples, that's 2 servings, and you have to know that. And the good news is it's 2 servings, so it gets you closer to 5. The bad news is that when you look at overconsumption, if you're counting 1 serving as 2, even with fruits, you can eventually overconsume. So it's an important number to know in both directions. A cup of mixed greens is a serving. That we tend to underestimate. We get a giant salad and say, I had a serving of vegetables, and it may be 2 or 3. And when you're eating mixed greens and most of your salad vegetables, the sky is the limit. You can't overeat those in terms of nourishment. So it's a great way to get a lot of vegetable servings in. A half a cup of cut-up fruits or vegetables, raw or cooked, is generally considered a serving. All of them have different nutrient values, and yes, some are more concentrated and some are a little higher in calories, but it's much easier to work with one general number than to try and say a third of a cup of this kind and a quarter of a cup of that kind and a half a cup of the other kind. So it's a good general statement. And 4 to 6 ounces of juice is considered a serving. Important thing to remember about juice, regardless of where it comes from, and even if it's 100% fruit juice, it's still concentrated calories and concentrated sugars, and it shouldn't be used for more than 1 serving of your fruits and vegetables a day. You know, if you are juicing things where you're getting most of the vegetable and fiber in, you can probably double that number. But if you're getting 100% apple juice or juicy juice or any other one, or orange juice, 4 to 6 ounces could be the equivalent of 4 to 6 pieces of fruit in terms of sugar content. So we really do have to look at caloric liquids. It isn't just soda. It isn't just Gatorade. That's a problem. 100% fruit juice is also a problem. So that's something to keep in mind. And the body doesn't account for liquid calories the way it does for solid calories. So if you drink 100 calories of juice, it's not going to have the same impact on everything else you eat as eating 100 calories worth of food. So it's much, much easier to consume too many calories when you're taking in a lot of calories as liquid. So how do we get to 5? None of these things are going to sound unfamiliar, I'm sure, but I'm going to go through them anyway just because it pays to go through them. Serve juice with breakfast, drink water the rest of the day. Serve raw vegetables as crunchy with meals and between meals. Even if your kids like chips, if you have the crunchy vegetables, they're going to eat a whole lot fewer of the chips. So you don't have to do deprivation, but you have to teach kids balance. Put lettuce, tomato, pepper strips on sandwiches. Imitate Subway. They got a whole selection of vegetables that you throw on top of everything else. You can get a third of a serving, or you can get an entire serving of vegetables, depending on how you put it together. Encourage kids to put fun things into salads. Mixed greens aren't very exciting, but garbanzo beans can be, and cut-up peppers can be. Things that are brightly colored can be. Get yellow peppers instead of, and red peppers instead of green ones, because it adds color, it adds sparkle. Try new vegetables, anything that they haven't tried before. If they make it themselves, they're more likely to eat it. That's one of the lessons that I certainly have learned. Offer fruit as snacks, offer it with peanut butter, cheese, or yogurt dip, so that you can have a sort of complete nutritious snack. And more. There are more than five ways. Cutting fruit into cereal, fresh, dried, or frozen. Frozen blueberries are great in oatmeal, and they're good for you. Make fruit muffins and fruit breads, pumpkin bread, blueberry bread, and use lots of fruits. Grow your own vegetables and fruits. Kids love going out and picking things, and they're much more likely to eat something that they have grown and picked than they are that you've brought home and is sitting on a shelf in the refrigerator. Take kids to farms and farmers markets. If you can't grow stuff yourself, go to the places where it's grown, go to the people who grow it, and let them get involved in the process. It's amazing how many kids don't know where food comes from. We live in a pretty rural community. Our kids are pretty good, but a lot of them really have no sense of the process of how a vegetable gets to their plate. And I think when they understand the process, they really do a whole lot better with it. You know, kids get familiar with what they see. When my daughter was very little, we spent a lot of time at a biodynamic farm, and it wasn't until she was about in high school that she figured out that the fruits and vegetables in the supermarket weren't all grown that way. It was sort of the reverse of what so many of our kids see, but it was a real demonstration of how kids learn from what they experience, and they assume that whatever they see is, they generalize it to the rest of the world. So let's give them the really good experience of how it's done so that they understand. And then, of course, get kids more involved in cooking. Again, they're more likely to eat something they have prepared. And they might even be more likely to be adventurous about preparing things that, let's try mixing this or putting these things together, you or I might think, I'm not so sure that's a good idea. But they put it together, and then they eat it. And that's a good thing. Color. This is very cute, but what it demonstrates is that when we're putting together food, we need to look at color. Not just because it catches the eye and makes food more interesting and makes us more likely to eat it, but because different colored foods bring different nutrients to the table. Your blues and purples, we learn more about all the time, fight sickness, bring vitamins and minerals. They have anti-inflammatory qualities. They're antioxidants. It means they help prevent cancer, they help prevent heart disease, those complications that Dr. Sylvia was talking about that we get from obesity, we also get from eating the wrong kinds of foods. We can be thin. If we're thin on junk, we're still not going to be healthy, and we're still going to have an increased risk of all of those diseases that she mentioned. Your blues, your purples, your yellows, your oranges, even your white foods. We always go through, I get lonely, eat white foods, and white foods aren't good. Not all white foods are good, but some of them are. White potatoes are actually a healthy food. They grow in the earth. They have vitamins. They have minerals. And they're something that we can have relatively fresh year-round in the Berkshires. So it's good to know that they're valuable. Cauliflower is a white food, and it's really good for you. So there are white foods that, turnips, parsnips, great things. I love the exploding pyramid, which is why I put it in here. I think you're all familiar. We'll see some real pyramids later on. But the food pyramid has been the guideline for quite a while as to what balance you should eat foods in. And at the top are the fats and the sweets and the not calorie-dense foods. And this is just a demonstration that the way we eat these days works. The pyramid is exploding out of the top. It's more like a volcano than a pyramid. And our goal is to sort of cap it and get some good ideas of how to balance it. So we've gone through fruits and vegetables. Is that all kids need? I don't think so. So they need protein. The guideline is protein 3 times a day. I've put in serving sizes, but I think it's really, really, really important to remember that kids know how much food they need. They know what they need. Parents, schools, communities, we draw the box. We say, these are the things that you can choose from on an everyday basis. But within those choices, kids are phenomenally capable of making good decisions. And, you know, when they're infants, we let them do that. We feed babies on demand. They cry, they're hungry, they've had enough, we stop. By the time they're 3, we start trying to mold them to the family schedule, to the community, to the daycare schedule, whatever schedule they need to participate in. And we tell them what, when, and how much. And by the time they enter school, it gets a whole lot worse. You have to be hungry before you leave. You have to have snack. You have to be hungry at lunchtime. You can't be hungry till school ends. You have to watch what you eat. Then you have to be hungry for dinner. And we spend a lot of years, and I think as adults we can relate to it, and as a kid, you probably can, that then we are supposed to make intelligent decisions about what it is we're going to eat and when and how much. But all our lives have been spent being told that somebody out there knows better. And they don't. So, again, I say protein 3 times a day. There are some people who need lots of protein, and there are some people who need very small amounts. There are some people who really need animal protein because it's a good concentrated form of protein, and there are some people who thrive on vegetable sources of protein. And we owe it to ourselves and our kids to sort of put this out as a guideline and then let them choose. Give them some space and some freedom to make those choices. Kids really don't overeat when you begin to give them control so that they're not using food for inappropriate reasons and you're not bargaining with them about food. So these are general guidelines. They need dairy products. Dairy is a source of calcium. The serving sizes that I've outlined here are based on providing about 300 milligrams of calcium. Kids need about 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day. So that's why those are serving sizes, is because of how much calcium they provide. If kids are allergic to dairy products, intolerant of dairy products, or just plain don't like them, there are other ways to get calcium. This is in the sort of conventional American way that we do it, but there are other ways to get it. Whole grains are really important. Most of the grains that we eat are not whole. On one side of the picture is the whole grain. It's got the bran and the germ and the center. We tend to refine it and make it into white flour or white rice or white anything. That's where the don't eat white foods comes from, is removing the bran and the germ and all of that. But we know whole grains are important, and we've come up with a great guideline, which is that 51% of the grains you consume should be whole. And it's a wonderful guideline because it's allowed General Mills, who I believe are the makers of Lucky Charms, to make whole grain Lucky Charms. Whole grains are good, but they're not the entire answer. So just because Lucky Charms are whole grain, I'm sorry, but they're still not nutritious. So we really do have to watch that kind of thing when we're going. Yeah, are they better than the original ones? Yes. But you still don't put them on the menu for breakfast. It's hard to eat 100% whole grains, and I am not a believer in perfection or setting ourselves up for perpetual failure. But I think that if you go with as much whole grain as you can do, you mix white rice with brown rice in the beginning to get used to the flavor. you get oatmeal bread instead of white bread. It's got some whole oats in it, even though it's got white flour. You move yourself along and you do it where you can. And again, I've got serving sizes, the number of servings that you need. Your grains are basically your energy food, and they sort of fill in. You've got all your fruits and vegetables, you've got your protein, and you've got your calcium source. And then particularly growing kids tend to need more energy, and how much of the grains they consume is sort of going to be appetite dependent. Again, we put out the good stuff, and then we let them choose how much they need. With kids who are using food for reasons other than hunger, there are a whole lot of interventions that we need to talk about. But as a general guideline, this tends to work. So how do we sort of make up a day? And there are many ways, and these are just examples of them. This is the American plate kind of guideline. The Cancer Society does an American plate. And this sort of gives you proportions of what part of your daily plate should come from fruit and vegetables. And as you can see, it is the largest, though it's not enough larger than bread, cereals, and potatoes for me. The potatoes are a vegetable, so we can slide the line over a little bit. Meat, fish, and protein alternatives, your dairy foods, and then your foods containing fat and sugar. And let me speak to fat and sugar for a minute. Fat is an essential nutrient. I have to say that every time I speak. We tend to forget it. We also tend to overdo it, and we tend to not differentiate between healthy fats and unhealthy fats. Fat is an essential nutrient. The healthiest fat you can eat is olive oil, followed by avocado, fish oils, and nut oils. The fats that come in red meat are the most difficult for the body to deal with because of the cholesterol and saturated fat. And then the third kind of fat, which is the artificial fat, artificially hydrogenated fats, which have trans fatty acids, are the most dangerous. And we are seeing a wonderful movement away from putting them in processed foods, but right now, every time you buy a processed food, even if it's a relatively healthy whole grain cracker, you need to look at the box. And if it's got partially hydrogenated fats in it, it most likely has trans fats, unless it's got a big sign on it that says zero trans fat, which really means less than 1% trans fat. So you have to think about that too. Zero doesn't mean zero. And if it's got less than one, then a serving is fine. It's got a very little bit, but when you have three or four servings, then you get up to measurable quantities. So the goal is to avoid them whenever possible. But fats are an essential nutrient, and they help us feel full. And if you go too low fat, what you end up with kids who are hungry all the time, and then what do they go for? They go for sugar and junk food. So it's not just keep fats out of the diet, think about the kinds. The other thing that I want to talk about for a minute is sugar. Sugar is a natural substance again. It's refined, but nature made it, and its chemical configuration isn't changed. Honey and maple syrup are less refined. Brown rice syrup, agave syrup are even closer to a natural state, but they're all sweeteners. Everybody can have some of them in their diet. Kids can probably get away with a little more, but you have to look at quantities and amounts. One of the mistakes we make in this culture is that somehow artificial sweeteners are better than natural sweeteners. And if you look at what's happened with vending machines, they have eliminated the sugary drinks from the vending machines, and they allow artificially sweetened drinks. I'm not sure that's a net gain for us. In preventing obesity, maybe in terms of overall health, not so. So that's the thing to think about with sugars. This is the original food guide pyramid. It had your breads and grains on the bottom that you were supposed to eat the most of, fruits and vegetables that you were supposed to eat a good quantity of but less, and then your proteins and your calciums, and then at the top was the used sparingly. That was your fats and sugars. It wasn't a great model. It didn't really take, nobody really quite understood how to use it, and I don't know whether the pyramid is the way to go or not, but as pyramids go, this is a really nice one. And the best thing about this pyramid is that the thing that it says you need the most of is water. So it starts us off at a good place. Liquids are important. And then it moves up to fruits and vegetables. A little heavier on the vegetables than the fruits, but it says basically those are the things that are going to be the basis of your diet. They help keep weight down, they help get nutrients in, they help keep energy level up, they provide fiber so that the digestion functions properly. They're wonderful. Then you move up to your grains, which are primarily whole grains. Then it lists the legumes, which are your vegetable sources of proteins, followed by your healthy fats and seasonings, then up to your dairy products and eggs, your fish and seafoods, followed by lean meats. So it's more detailed, and it actually does a better job of representing what a balanced diet should look like. This comes from the University of Michigan. If you go to the website, it's interactive, so you can get more information from it. But as food pyramids go, it's a good guideline for how we should eat. The other component of remaining healthy, and I think that this is really important, is physical activity. You can eat as well as you want. If you never move off the sofa or away from the computer table or the desk, it's not going to help you a whole lot, either in maintaining a healthy weight or in generally being healthy. So that's really important. So what I've done is my basic guidelines for everybody here, just sort of as a review. And what I didn't put on it, because it's on my latest version, but I didn't get it into this one, is that the first one is eat food in as close to its natural state as possible. What that means is, it's the example of the apple juice, 100% apple juice. You have an apple over here, then it becomes apple juice. The apple in a glass of water is better for you than the apple juice, which is far better for you than the apple pie. So we sort of move along the spectrum. The eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, eat every 3 or 4 hours during the day. One of the cultural things that we don't do well. Our body needs to know on a regular basis that food is coming into it. So going for 6 hours between lunch and dinner is not healthy. It may be that, you know, we do the 3 meals a day, particularly if you want to lose weight. You're actually better off eating enough food to burn in 4 hours and then eating again. Because after 4 hours, your body does take what's left in the bloodstream and start socking it away as fat. And if you don't feed it again, it also gets the message that we're entering times of famine. We live in caveman bodies. We really haven't changed much since we had major times of feast and famine. So your body gets that message, and then the next time food comes in, it doesn't even wait the 4 hours before it starts socking it away. Drinking water all day long, it helps to regulate appetite. We frequently eat when we're thirsty, and we just don't know we're thirsty. And if we wait till we're thirsty to drink, we've waited too long. So having water around all the time is really helpful. Protein at least 3 times a day. As I said, quantity and quality is a highly individual decision. Calcium-rich foods, or take a supplement. So you've got dairy products. You've also got nuts and seeds that are high in calcium, and vegetables that you can get plenty of calcium from, or supplementing. But it is important to get enough calcium. Salt in moderation. Sodium is an essential nutrient, again. We can't just plain cut it out, and everybody's salt needs are different. Again, if we don't overdo it with too much salt, our palate really tells us when we need salt. Refined sugar 1 to 2 times a day, it's an awareness thing. Start thinking about what you're putting in your mouth, what you're putting on the table, what you're offering, and see how much of it has refined sugar in it. Zero is a great number. I try to get sort of to a reality that we can live with, because again, if you strive for perfection, you set yourself up for failure, and then you say, why bother at all? So we have to look at balance. Limit sources of cholesterol and saturated fat, and that's the heart disease preventive piece of it. Really important message that most of us aren't real good at, and that's to learn to eat when you're hungry, eat what you are hungry for, and stop when you're not hungry anymore. Not when you're full, not when you're stuffed, because you don't have to go 6 hours or 8 hours before you can eat again. And then exercise and breathing. Breathing is always very handy. So that's sort of the general approach. What we wanted to do was present and then really open it up for discussion, questions, or anything else. So that's what we will do now. I'm going to pick up that microphone and bring it around to anyone who has a question. I think it's locked.
Do you have any suggestions for a three-year-old who used to eat great and now has only started eating peanut butter, cheese, yogurt, and applesauce? That's about the basis of his diet right now.
It's not a bad variety for a three-year-old. Kids go through food jags. And generally, we should let them. It's the parent's job to offer a variety of nutritious foods in a form that the kid can eat easily, in a pleasant environment, on a regular schedule. It's the child's job to eat. William Dietz, who's one of the experts on childhood obesity as well as failure to thrive, I was at a conference and he said, the harder you try to get a child to eat anything, the less likely they are to eat. And I was with a whole group of nutritionists who were saying, what if the child isn't growing? And he just kept repeating himself. The harder you try, the less likely they are to eat it. So we look at how kids are growing. If they're not growing well, if their energy level is low, if they're pale, if they're not concentrating well, if they're not gaining and growing well, we do need to find a way to get them to change what they're eating. Most children, that's not the case. And as long as their choices are nutritious and we encourage them to taste new things on a regular basis, that's the best we can do. And most of them come through those food jags and come out the other end and begin to eat a variety of food again. But when it becomes a battle and a struggle, they're less likely to come out of it as quickly, because then they have a point to make. So again, if the foods that you described are basically nutritious foods, we've got most of the food groups, we're missing vegetables. So I would certainly encourage every night or every day, taste one at lunch, taste one at dinner. But that's the best we can do. By three, they can understand. You need to take a taste of it. At your age, your taste changes every week, every month, every whatever. So you need to keep trying. Are we going to make them eat a mound full of them? There's really nothing to be gained from that in the long run.
And just so I can add, in the literature it shows that to introduce a new food to like a toddler, it might take 10 to 15 tries for them to really decide if they like it or not. So don't get frustrated after the first few.
Is this on?
Yeah.
My son, who is 13 now, acts as if sugar is a drug he's addicted to. Do you have experience with that and how to fight that?
The first way to fight it is elimination. It can be a drug. For some people, it absolutely can be a drug. You may be able to speak to some of the behavioral stuff also, but my question is, does he see it as a problem at all? Does he see any of his behaviors as a problem? To me, the first thing would be to look at what the problem behaviors it creates are. Certainly in the home, you can limit what's available. Can we limit what's available outside of the home? We can't. But I certainly would limit what's available in the home. And not as punishment, but as this is the way we eat in the home. Beyond that, I have done it, but it's sort of developing an individual strategy for the family. If you see it as creating problem behaviors, then it needs attention. And as I said, the first place that I do it is, where is he getting the sugar? If he's getting it in my house, I get rid of it. If he's getting it elsewhere, don't set yourself up for making rules that you know that you can't enforce, because it's a setup for failure. But certainly pointing out to him the problem behaviors that it's creating and seeing how he responds to that. But there are people who are very sugar sensitive, and it's sort of an addiction cycle. Leveling blood sugars helps that cycle to some degree. If we let kids get hungry or if we let them fill up on sugar, their blood sugars go up and down like a roller coaster, and they just crave sugar. And they get it, and they get energy, and then they get this low, and then they eat sugar, and then they get a high, and they get a low. So we try to do that by encouraging consumption of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and proteins.
Yeah, you can also develop or steer an intolerance. You know, I grew up on whole milk. Now I find anything above 1% greasy. And I think it's, you just have to wean down. And, you know, I find the same with most granolas, greasy. Thank you.
Deb, do you know anything about food and its relationship to learning disabilities?
So I don't think there's been any, like, one food class that's been directly related to learning disabilities. In older studies, like high sugar, are they really hyperactive? Things like that, preservatives in food, is that causing a learning disability? I think when you look at if they're having any illnesses, diabetes before diagnosed or problems with sugar, if they're having low blood sugars, then they can't concentrate, then they're missing out in school. So maybe their attention span. You know, if they're having obstructive sleep apnea, that's undiagnosed, not sleeping well, falling asleep in school, have decreased attention span, I think that's kind of where we're finding some connection with different disorders in learning disabilities. I don't think there's been any specific that's been able to directly be related to, you know, attention deficit and hyperactive.
You know, there's some research that is going on now that talks about food allergies and learning disabilities or food intolerances. There's a whole body of literature on autism and wheat-free and casein-free diets, which is dairy and wheat. And there seems to be some credibility to it for some kids. The other allergy stuff is not well documented. I said there's a lot of research going on, and most conventional allergists don't do the kind of testing that even picks up those subtle food reactions. So it tends to be hit or miss. There's other kinds of allergy testing that tests for what are called IgG levels, which is different from the primary allergy response. And some people believe that IgG-mediated food allergies may affect behavior in some way. Some people find that when they do elimination diets based on those diagnoses, those CCs, they feel better. But it's not in the mainstream. So I would say that probably for some people, a food reaction can cause a learning disability for the same reasons that Dr. Sylvia talked about. When, you know, food reactions are, if you think of an allergy and itching, it's sort of like itching inside. It's an irritability. It's a distraction. It's something that keeps you from being able to focus properly. The autism piece, which talks about metabolic pathways, and that some people with autists in the autistic spectrum have different metabolic pathways, which is why, so that's why those foods interfere with normal development for them. There just hasn't been enough research to determine whether there are other learning disabilities that might be associated with altered metabolic pathways. Does that make sense? So that's sort of the undocumented, unproven, new, being researched as we speak area, but there isn't any good concrete literature.
Has there been more research about genetically modified foods and how that affects children and their development?
Not enough. It is of concern. The biggest concern, as far as I'm concerned, about genetically modified foods is that we don't know anything about it. I don't know that we have anything concrete to say there's a problem with it, but just like whether it's trans fatty acids or artificial sweeteners, we're creating things that don't necessarily occur in nature, and the question always is, what are our bodies going to do with them? And as far as I know, there are no concrete answers at this point.
Just addressing that question, I have a PhD in genetics, and I have looked into this somewhat, and I would say that is not where the big concern is, that the odds of us having health problems from modifications that are made in our food are very low. They're not zero, but they're very low. The main problems with the whole industry have more to do with the environment and political questions, and in particular, they're growing drugs in plants now, often in open fields. That's not good. But in terms of our kids, I'm not particularly worried.
Even though 60% of the corn in the marketplace is genetically modified, do we say, and that would be the most dominant food modified product. Soybeans, likewise. Can you address specifically those two products? Are you feeling comfortable with those two products?
Do you remember the Starlink episode? That was where something that had raised a red flag as a potential human allergen made it into some products on the human market. It was meant to be shunted only to animal feed, got into the human. So what I understand is that there's no proven case of a human reaction to that. And from a scientific point of view, the stuff shouldn't have made it to humans. And you know, I think that episode has tightened the controls a bit. You know, from the side of the regulators, you know, they had figured out there was a potential problem and had marked it. It's further down the line, lack of oversight where the problem came. So as far as I know, all of those products are okay. The fact that it's 60 or whatever percent now isn't the issue. It's, you know, they do look at what the proteins they're putting in, what dangers they might cause, and the red flags are there. They've shied away from those things, and I think because they recognize that the downstream, you know, the oversight is sloppy.
And I would certainly echo your concern for the environment as a much more significant one with our genetic.
In relation to allergies, I know the school I teach at Herberg, there's almost an exponential rise in kids allergic to peanut butter, for example. And I'm not sure what the causes of that, or if there's any research on that.
The research seems to be, there are a couple of things. One is that we live in a more toxic environment, so we're more likely to react to a whole host of things. Our systems are battered by a lot more things than they used to be. There is some evidence that prenatal exposure to potential allergens, peanuts and eggs being at the top of the list, may increase the incidence of allergies. Early exposure, and it's not that we feed our two-month-olds peanut butter, but there are nuts in so many things, and therefore airborne nut, I'm at a loss for the word, but there are airborne things, just like there are kids who can't literally be in a room with peanuts. So we may just have much more exposure. You know, we used to live in a time when we didn't have the abundance that we have now, so that maybe you had peanuts 3 months out of the year and then you really didn't have them much the rest of the year, and we now have them, they're now in our environment on a daily basis. And there is some evidence that overexposure to almost any food or food group can create an allergy. And probably thirdly, we have more allergic people surviving to reproduce. Things that people would have died of before they're not dying of, and they're hitting reproductive age and they're reproducing, so we've got genetics feeding into it also. So those are all the pieces that I have read about as potential contributors to the rise in the incidence of the anaphylactic allergies. I think the milder allergies, we're just doing an incredibly much better job of recognizing reactions as reasons for problems, and we just didn't know that before.
Just additionally on that question, is this mainly a Western phenomena, this increase in allergies in children? I mean, is this, you know, when you're talking about culturally, you know, we have such an abundance here, but what about in other cultures where they don't have this abundance? Is,
I don't know.
I wonder.
That's
if
a very good question. Do you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I can't answer that. I'm just trying to think of the research studies because there's a lot of schools of thoughts of why there's been an increase in allergens. And I'm just trying to think of the studies. They're usually mostly small studies, and I can't say that they've made a diagnosis between different cultural aspects. So.
Diet and, possible lack of exercise. I think I'm concerned about, like, when would I turn to maybe his self-esteem? He's not really doing okay in school, but... You know, some days are better than others. So I'm wondering, what's going on? Maybe I should turn to some possible therapy to go along with changing up his diet, because he's a potato chip, salt. I wish there were more exercise, but unfortunately right now there's not in his daily activity. But now I'm wondering, when should I possibly think maybe self-esteem? Maybe there's something else going on. I should have that evaluated. Would that be something that I should think about doing?
Okay. So self-esteem should be a concern for any parent with anything. And I would start first with maybe trying to kind of solve the problem slowly. And then also put a positive note. Have them pick something that they like to do that they feel they're good at, because then they always have something to feel more proud of, to build the self-esteem, and that will usually then cross over into other areas. You don't have to sometimes directly attack that one issue, and you can try kind of doing it in a circumventory way, unless it becomes like a serious issue that now they're uninvolved. They won't even try anything new. So then if that comes to that point, then we may want to see therapy. What are the other issues that are bothering them? Are they actually depressed versus just kind of feeling down or unconfident?
And it doesn't necessarily have to do with depression or lack of motivation, but when you talked about the potato chip salt kind of person, is looking at, we actually make associations, and as I said, salt is an essential nutrient, and some people need it. If it's salt he needs, looking for a potato chip may be the association. So sometimes you can pull apart what they're craving and say that maybe a hard-boiled egg with salt or celery, which is salty by itself or with some salt, may be a better alternative if it's really a salt craving, and it could be. So the other thing is really to look at the foods they're craving, what those foods bring, and are there other healthier vehicles for crunch, for salt, for healthier fats, or whatever the food, but begin to pull it apart that way. And sometimes you can make substitutions, again, not in a punitive way, but in a, if you're craving something salty, why don't you try this instead? If you're looking for a crunch, why don't you try this instead? So that's just another way to address some of the food-related, the ways we use food to meet those kinds of sensations.
This is sort of a, not so much a question, I'm just wondering if you could make some comments about this. We're talking about food, we're talking about children. One of the things, your pyramids were very attractive, but I find that as people go through life, that pyramid is just a sort of a standard guideline. And I was thinking, there was a gentleman who actually got up and left, but I believe he deals with students at Hampshire College. So I'm thinking about college-age students, I'm thinking about menopausal women, I'm thinking about elderly people who may be on a lot of medication, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of direction for their dietary needs. And then the other question, or joining in with that, something I haven't heard mentioned at all today, we've talked about food, growing it, we talked about water, but I'm not hearing and exercise, I'm not hearing a lot about sleep. So I'm wondering if you could just address that.
I'll start, and then I'm going to transfer sleep over to Dr. Sylvia. But I think you're absolutely right. These are all guidelines. And when I do those basic guidelines, it's why they're that general. I think that every single one of us is different. College kids, I like to try and make sure they know something before they go off to college, because it's really easy to make bad decisions in a college environment. You know, eating in a cafeteria three meals a day anywhere, it's not just college that does it to you. But, yeah, the guidelines are just what they are. The really important thing, I go back to learning to listen to our bodies in an effective way, which, as I said, through most of our schooling, we don't get the opportunity to do. We're told what we're supposed to eat, when we're supposed to eat it, and how we're supposed to eat it, as opposed to being given appropriate limits. In other words, you don't say, here's ice cream, cookies, cake, and candy, or you can have some broccoli. that doesn't really work. But if in the home, as kids are growing up, there are healthy choices, and if you don't like what's on the dinner table, there are other healthy choices that you can get. No one's going to be a short order cook making them for you. That we help kids not lose that ability to listen to their own bodies. You know, tell me the difference between a bowl of whole grain cereal and milk and meat, potatoes, and vegetables at dinner. Is meat, potatoes, and vegetables necessarily always important? And if they're interested in something lighter, if they're going to make an equally healthy choice, we need to begin to let them, because then when they go off to college, they understand what their body is telling them and that listening to it makes sense and works and makes them healthy. So I think that's important. When you go to menopausal women, at each phase of life, those guidelines shift a little, but we're really highly individual. And either you've got to figure out how to listen to your own body or go talk. You know, as a nutritionist, that's what I do with people. I help them talk out what they need to do. I don't hand out, I don't say, oh, you're at this point in your life, here's what you're supposed to do. I say, what do you do now? What works, what doesn't work? What can you give up, what can't you give up? You know, mostly, well, some come because their cholesterol is high, some come because their blood pressure is high, some come because they've been diagnosed with diabetes. Others come because they're feeling fatigued, they don't have the energy they want. They're going through menopause, and they know they need to be doing something different but can't on their own figure out what to do. Some are unhappy with their weight. They haven't been diagnosed as having a problem, but they're not happy, underweight, overweight, one or the other. I've had young men come and say, I can't gain weight, as often as I've had young women come and say, I need to lose weight. So some come because they just have a sense that something isn't right. I've had parents come in with kids who are fine, but there are all sorts of questions about feeding behaviors, which is a wonderful opportunity to talk about helping kids learn to listen to their own bodies. There's a wonderful book called Preventing Childhood Eating Problems that is about teaching kids on-demand eating at any age, so that even if you haven't done it and they're 13, it's not too late. There are some very good books. There's something called The Slowdown Diet by Mark David, which is very nice. But yeah, it's really, I do a wellness exercise and weight management class with adults, and I send them home saying things like, you know, on a Saturday when you're going to be home and have choices, eat half as much as you usually eat for lunch and just see what happens. See when you get hungry again. See how hungry you get. See what you get hungry for, so you can begin to learn about hunger and fullness. We do a lot of experiments like that so that you can relearn those natural cues. So, as I said, for me, the bottom line is teaching people to listen to their bodies and giving them enough information that when their bodies tell them things, they, you know, like I'm eating chips, I'm craving salt and fat. Well, what are healthier sources of these? You have to have that information if you're going to make that transition. So it's a combination of listening to your body and having the information about what are better choices to plug into those things. So yeah, these guidelines are just that. They're a generic idea of what you should be doing and where you should be going. But people frequently come to me and say, tell me what I should eat, tell me when I should eat. And I keep saying, I can't do that. Well, I don't have that magic wand.
People are thirsty and so they eat. So I think our bodies trick us a lot. I think for people to be in touch with their bodies is more of a challenge than we realize.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I agree. I send people home and they say, oh, I can do that. And I say, well, give it a try. Come back and tell me what didn't work, because it's not as easy.
Yeah, I think in the same way as you alluded, thirst equates to appetite. Lack of sleep does a similar thing.
So sleep is very important for a healthy lifestyle. General, like infants, guidelines, 16 to 14 hours. As they become, you know, a little older in the toddler kind of age, almost 12 to 10. So, and then when they start getting older, adolescents, still 10 to 8. So, and these are also all guidelines. And even for adults, you know, usually 10 to 8, maybe 6. But I guess the most important is trying to stick to a regular schedule to have a healthy sleep routine that you teach your kids. No TVs, no video games in the bed, no doing homework in the bed. You need to have a separate place for all of those areas, in that the bed's only associated really for sleep and restful time. And then generally just keeping the routine the same, even on the weekends. If they have to be up at 7 to start getting ready for school, to let them sleep till 9 sometimes and 10 on the weekends, they're going to have problems on Monday. So you're going to either have to recognize that or try to get them up a little earlier, 8, 8:30, to keep them in the routine, in that it's, you know, healthier. So then they'll fall asleep easier. If you let them sleep till 10, which you probably know as you get up and go to work earlier and you sleep later on Saturday and Sunday, it's harder for you to go to sleep a little earlier that day so you can get up for work on Monday. But yes, health and keeping a healthy lifestyle, sleep is very important.
I just wanted to make a comment about the eating behaviors, like the sugar craving, because my concern would be getting into power struggles. And so I was thinking of a more indirect route of foods available that might help balance out their diet in general. And I think a lot of it would be the family meal schedule and what's on the counter that's easy to grab, but probably focus on protein to start.
Any other questions or comments? Well, then thank you all for coming. I hope it was useful. I hope it was helpful. And it sounds like it was a great day. So,
Deb Phillips, local nutritionist and health educator, speaking on the topic Nutrition and Children's Health Concerns in America Today at a conference presented by Berkshire Grown and co-sponsored by the Massachusetts Farm to School Project. The conference was called A Conference on Farm to School Connections. If you're interested in the topic of nutrition and children's health concerns, WBCR has a program on Wednesday mornings at 8 o'clock. It's called Food for Thought, Children, Nutrition, and Learning. It's hosted by Dr. Larry Bronstein, a chiropractor and nutritionist at Mehewi Chiropractic and Holistic Health Services, and Deborah Alexson, special educator and founder of Alternative Learning Strategies. That's Wednesdays from 8 to 9, and they have a discussion of issues related to children's health, how they affect learning. They have interviews with professionals from different disciplines who work with children, and they present current events and new research in the topic. And Deb Phillips has been a guest on more than one occasion of that on that program. So tune in Wednesdays at 8, Food for Thought, Children, Nutrition, and Learning.
You have been listening to Locally Grown. Locally Grown is an audio magazine produced exclusively for WBCR-LP in Great Barrington. Opinions expressed on this program belong to those that express them, and not necessarily to members or programmers at WBCR. Questions, comments, or suggestions for this program can be addressed by email to locally_grown@mac.com. That is locally_grown@mac.com. You can contact this station at 644-9797. That number again, 644-9797, or by email at info at berkshireradio.org. That email address again, info@berkshireradio.org. Thank you for listening to our program. Bye.